In that state of consciousness, seconds, onds, hours, or years no longer matter, because time and space have been transcended. This infinite eternity is the true nature of the mind, the awake self within all of us. While with these beings, Wiko created a code for humans communicating with them. This was actually the birth of the S5, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, initiative. We utilized not only sounds and light but also non-local consciousness and directed coherent thought to communicate with extraterrestrial beings and their electronic devices. This was October of 1973, during the time of the Yom Kippur War. It was clear to me that the ETs wanted humans to move beyond mutually assured destruction and into a peaceful civilization that could co-exist with space in harmony. Earth needed to find people to be ambassadors for this objective, and so, I offer to do this, and to help teach the same to our fellow humans. Nothing more, just that. Then very suddenly I returned to a regular state of awareness and found myself back on the gravel road near the fire tower, a little further down the path from my previous spot, but still at the top of the ridge. I thought, oh, my God, how wonderful. The experience of oneness with them had a key message. The conscious mind we are awake with at this moment is the same as that of the divine being, and of all beings. Erwin Schrödinger was absolutely correct when he said the total number of minds in the universe is one. There is one conscious mind, and we are it. So, there are only one people in the universe, and we are they. No alien or human, just an unbroken, perfect, seamless conscious life in the universe, and we are all a part of it. I'm reminded of a saying from the Sufi tradition, "Thinkest thyself a puny form when within thee the universe is folded?" It's a rhetorical question. We're not just this puny form. The entirety of the universe is folded within us. And that's really what I experienced with the ETs. They know that the only chance for peace on Earth, never mind the cosmos, is for humans to understand there's no real difference amongst us. It doesn't matter how we look. Consider the variety in physical appearances that exists on Earth alone. What really matters is that within us lives the same singular light of consciousness, infinite, eternal and always present, whether we're open to it or not at any given moment in time. It is the basis of our relationship with each other and with the universe. This is enduring and eternal, and that is what we experienced in its absolute, purest form. It was beyond beautiful. And there was absolutely nothing frightening about it. It didn't matter that I was only 18. They didn't care about such things as age, race, family of origin, or wealth. They cared about the fact that I was pure-hearted enough to see the truth clearly and unattached to the materiality of this world. I could discern the universal aspect of teachings in various cultures that humans have learned through the ages, because truth is one and the same in any language. What we created together that day proved that humans can be, each of us, connected to each other and to the unbounded awareness of the universe, but also to these other civilizations, if we simply understand the fact that we're awake. If you are awake, reading this or hearing this right now, the awakeness whereby you're hearing it is a singularity. And it isn't divided, Ed. We divide it into our own egos and intellect, but in reality, the light of awareness is the same in every being, in every star. And the entire cosmos is suffused in this same light of being. There is this great sun of awareness reflecting and refracting in everyone, yet still singular. So, if you return to that and if you experience it, none of these life forms seem far away or unusual, or alien, because they really are not. So, it was on this occasion the Xeti concept of one universe, one people was conceived. There is really one people in the universe, and we are they. There is a single conscious being shining in all of us. It can never be divided, no matter how much we try. We may want to divide it, but it's always one. It's always a singularity, always perfect. The extraterrestrial beings that are here understand this, because they cannot travel through interstellar space without understanding non-locality. And understanding non-locality, necessitates a high level of knowledge and enlightenment. In a real sense, then, the heart of compassion and the foundation of peace is found in the reality that we are all one. Without that experience, intellectualism is all that's left, and it never lasts. So, I came to realize at a rather young age that the world's problems are essentially spiritual, therefore the solutions must be spiritual as well. And so it has turned out to be. I found myself back on the mountain under the beautiful, starry sky, only to experience another strange phenomenon. I was perhaps 100 yards further down the gravel road. As I started down the mountain, I found that with each step, I was in a state of near weightlessness, as if walking on the moon. My steps were actually leaps of 20 to 30 feet at once. It was more like floating than walking. There was a strange, magnetic, anti-gravitational effect around me, making me lighter. It wasn't a product of my imagination, my physical body was light. I was just happy as a lark. Here I was, fresh from this experience on an ETV, and now bounding down the mountain, traveling in boing, boing, boing leaps across impossible distances with each step. It was incredibly blissful. As I got closer to town, the phenomenon faded, and my weight returned to normal. Upon reaching the little town of Boone, it looked so deserted I thought there had been a nuclear war. I thought it was about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, everything should have been open. Remember, it's a little college town up in the North Carolina mountains. I thought to myself, what in the world is going on? I wonder if the Yom Kippur War got out of control and there was a thermonuclear war and I'm the last to know? A check of the time told me, it was nearly 1 a.m. My cosmic experience had lasted 3 or 4 hours. After this amazing evening, I decided to practice all I had learned, taught and shared with the extraterrestrials. Every night before going to sleep, I would lie down and put myself in a meditative state. I would enter unbounded awareness, then expand the sense of conscious mind around me, filling the room, knowing that it was omnipresent. On the wings of that omnipresent sense of awareness, I would expand upwards into space, seeing the stars and space, filled with the sense that it was awake. And I was one with that awakeness, which placed me out there, in space. Then I would send a thought like a beacon to the extraterrestrial beings, to announce my presence. In a somewhat childlike way, I'd say, I don't know if you remember me, but my name is Steve. And here I am, let me show you where I am. So, I would do the protocol we developed for this 5 initiative. In this higher state of consciousness I would turn it around, and instead of seeing outward into the vastness of space, look back, and show the ETs my location on Earth. I would show them the Milky Way galaxy and then zoom in from the to our solar system, with the Sun and the Earth. Then I would zoom to the Earth and North America, further into the eastern United States and the Appalachian Mountains. Then I would zoom in to show them my location in Boone, North Carolina, then to my exact spot in that building. And with that, I would fall asleep. For months my experiences were really quite extraordinary. From October 73 onwards, there began an unprecedented wave of UFO sightings in those mountains. I did this as a way of beta testing the system, to see if what we had co-created and agreed upon on the ship would actually work. Well, it did. There were newspaper reports of forest rangers seeing these huge ships hovering over the mountains, down in Shining Rock Wilderness to the south, and over in the Linville Gorge area. Here, there, and everywhere. I continued to do this until one day, in the local paper, a story appeared about a guy driving nearby on a road outside Morganton, North Carolina. As ETVs travel, it was only seconds away from me. This boy, who looked a lot like me, was driving on that road, and the car suddenly stopped. There was a ship hovering by the road, with an ET at the boy's window. The driver was completely freaked out. I saw this as an indirect way for the ETs to say, you know, we're getting this. So I thought to myself, well, I'm playing around with fire, here. I think, Until I figure out what I'm supposed to do with this, this is enough. I didn't tell anyone about this episode for a very long time. However, people need to understand why I gave up an established medical career, and the $250,000 per year that came with it, to make known what I know to be true. Certainly not because it's only a theory. While still in this state, asleep, I continued to have some kind of ongoing dialogue with these extraterrestrial beings. My roommate told me quite some time later, that for a number of months he would awaken late at night, and would hear me speaking quietly in my sleep. He said, "You were speaking, but with a language not of this world." And I thought, "Oh, my God." Somehow, I was in a state of consciousness where I could connect to the language used by the ETs. And he was hearing that very clearly. He said, "Absolutely, it was not an Earth language." After this, I pretty much decided that, until I had a specific reason to utilize these protocols I experienced with the ETs, it would be wiser to be just quietly aware of the ability, but keep it to myself. In 1974, I left the traditional college at Boone to enter teacher training at Maharishi International University in Iowa. My experiences in the training there were really quite extraordinary, in part because I remained independent in terms of the institutional, dogmatic aspects of the group. However, there was an enormous amount of profound knowledge being discussed. I immersed myself in the study of the Vedas and the Sanskrit language. I was enormously impressed with the amount of knowledge in the Vedas, how the experience of consciousness and universal awareness was articulated. This experience enabled me to have a time and place to be completely dedicated to the development of higher states of consciousness. One of the most profound things I absorbed was the unfolding of the cosmology. This came not so much from didactic learning as from direct experience, which included the astral or causal thought realms and the realms of light. Once one understands the structure of creation and begins to experience it in detail, it becomes very understandable how people can have dreams of the future, alter their physical body to levitate, or to materialize and reappear in another place. All the things you've heard about in what are considered mythological stories or so called miracles become more comprehensible. They are also completely attainable by every single conscious human being. All beings will one day be capable of experiencing these things. The abilities are birthright, not just humans, but every conscious being in the universe. We are all children of God and all of these gifts and states exist within each of us. That year, I began to have experiences that brought the infinite being into this world. I could see a rock and know that it also contains pure awareness. Within the rock is the energy and the frequency of a light form, an astral form that gives its structure and its crystalline matrix form. And within that is the idea of it, and within the idea is the primal thought that created all things. And within that is pure, quiet conscious mind. In fact, the totality of everything is nothing but pure conscious awareness, phasing, resonating and playing in different forms and in different ways. Much of the knowledge that goes with this has to be realized from experience. The good news is that everyone, at some time in their life, has experienced that type of integration and oneness. They just have to remember it. My intention is to try to describe it in a way that will help you remember. If I could accomplish this from my personal background, having grown up with a total absence of exposure to the world of spirituality, then anyone can. As all of this began to unfold, I dedicated myself for a number of years to teaching meditation and higher states of consciousness. During those years, I took an advanced course in the Catskills, in New York. On that retreat, I fasted and spent several hours a day in meditation, in a really beautiful, quiet state. I began to awaken to an ability I'd had since childhood, but then only beginning to emerge, of being able to see things within consciousness that were not visible to the naked eye. Walking down a corridor, I would try to see what was around the corner. Almost every time, I would see what was there or who was coming. And I wasn't trying to guess until I got it right. It was like staying in a steady state of consciousness and actually seeing it. Then I would attempt to see things happening at a distant point on Earth or at a distant point in time, the next day or the next week. I practiced this a great deal. It became routine for me to be able to go to sleep and see a distant place or event, and know what was going to happen the next day. Now, this is no mystery, if you understand the omnipresent nature of consciousness. Because it is omnipresent, it is beyond the restrictions of time or space, which means that you can break those bonds through entering this state of awareness. And when you do, you will find yourself able to see things one isn't supposed to be able to see. Space and time are obliterated, and you are free to really see. One day during this retreat I wondered about some of the so-called siddhis, or spiritual powers, described in the Vedas. I thought it would be interesting to test the limits of this for the physical body. Began to think about the abilities we have, if we are all consciousness and our bodies are actually filled with the light of awareness. What might we really achieve? Well, one day I was in an enormously happy, joyful, peaceful state. I was out walking on a magnificent, clear spring day. Being so affected by earth and nature, the moment was right for what followed. As I was walking in the field behind the manor where we were staying, I spontaneously, without effort or forethought, levitated. It was reminiscent of that prolonged experience of bounding down the mountainside after my ET encounter in October of 73. This time I just lifted vertically, maybe 2 or 3 feet above the ground. Instead of walking to my destination, I glided there in an upright, vertical levitation experience. And then at the moment my intellect kicked in and I exclaimed, "My God, look what's happening. How can I be doing this?" I settled down to earth. It was halted by my own intellect and ego. One of the many lessons I learned from this is that there's a certain grace, along with faith, needed for such extraordinary experiences. I don't mean religious faith per se, but the certainty of, or knowing the capacity latent within. It is beyond self, ego, and intellect. If we can give ourselves freely to it, incredible things can be accomplished. And if it fails to flow, it's because we are stopping it. Ultimately, it is recognizing and embracing the power of God within each of us. After this experience, it became increasingly clear that we have within us any capability, and that anyone can acquire and develop them. We're coming into an era where such things will become routine and accepted as the norm. There is sometimes a tendency by people involved in various spiritual and religious groups to put people who have this level of experience or knowledge on a pedestal, as if it's unattainably unique. It's not, and that's very important to understand. It is, in fact, a disservice to the nature and potential of humanity to idolize something that should be understood as the birthright of everyone. In 1975, I went with some friends to Isola, France, up in the Maritime Alps, to become instructors of meditation. While on this particular retreat, I had a number of experiences with higher states of consciousness, what might be called unity consciousness and God consciousness. One day, remembering what had happened 2 years earlier in the North Carolina mountains, I wondered if that same extraordinary experience could be repeated. So in the hotel room, I went through the protocol we'd created in 1973 on that spacecraft. I then went into the state of unbounded consciousness, and then expanded awareness off the mountain, around the Alps, into space, and out into our solar system. Seeing the vastness of space, I said to these craft and the ETs on board, "My name is Steve. I don't know if you remember me, but we met a couple of years ago, and now here I am up in the French Maritime Alps, in Isola." And so I showed them the beautiful spiral galaxy, the Milky Way, our star system with the Sun and its planets, and the Earth. And then I zoomed into Europe, to the Maritime Alps of France. I showed them our location in the hotel complex and said, "If you can come visit, please do." This occurred in an unbroken flow of consciousness for about 20 minutes later. After lunch, some friends and I decided to go for a walk in the mountains near the hotel. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I looked up in the crystal clear, alpine sky to see a beautiful, huge tetrahedral-shaped ship, shining in the sun. It was clear and fully materialized, and drawing down towards us, silently. A good friend in the group who knew of my experiences with extraterrestrial vehicles gasped, "My God, Steve, did you call them here?" And she just came unglued. "Oh, my God, I can't believe it." And I replied, "Yeah, I did. I did this protocol that I told you about." She asked, "My God, why didn't you warn me?" At the point this anxiety was shown by some of the group, the ETV stopped approaching us, hovered, and then backed off silently. Then this huge craft just completely dematerialized, disappeared out of our space, time. I turned to her and smiled, "Well, I guess the protocol does work." And she says, "My God, next time, let me know. Warn me before you're going to do it." But I was laughing hysterically. This taught me that, in fact, we could contact the ETs and this could be experienced by others. It was the first time since I was 9 years old that I had actually seen one of these ET craft in the company of other people. In this case, it was a truce, 5, where a human invited the craft and they came, witnessed by others. Clearly, the protocols worked. I began to feel that maybe this should be taught to people at some point, because everyone should learn that this is possible. But as time passed, I began to question it again. When something this extraordinary happens, doubts always creep in. After a while, I was living back in the mountains of North Carolina, outside of Blowing Rock, with a friend who had been on the training course. We had become teachers of meditation together. One day in late fall 1977 I decided to test the protocol again. That night I sat up in bed and meditated. I went into the expanded state of consciousness, felt it expanding into space, saw the fullness and infinity of space being filled with the light of awareness, and in that light I saw these extraterrestrial people and said, "Again, my name is Steve." But, thinking so much time had passed that maybe they didn't remember, I said, "Well, my name is Steve Greer and I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina on June 28, 1955. I then gave them an entire brief biography. I showed them Charlotte, and how to get to my location. From space, they could go to Charlotte, then up to the North Carolina mountains, about 100 miles away. After following this technique in a stream of consciousness, I fell asleep. Suddenly, I awakened in the wee hours of the morning between 1 and 4 a.m. and here was this beautiful blue, white craft outside the window, and about 30 feet above the house. And the consciousness of the occupant was being projected right into the room I was in. It was very palpable. We were out in the middle of nowhere, totally surrounded by mountains and meadows and silence. And here was this ship silently hovering right outside my window. Suddenly my housemate woke up in his bedroom, jumped up, rushed into my room and exclaimed, "Do you see that?" I said, "Yes," kind of sheepishly, like, "Oh." And he says, "My God, there's a spaceship right outside our window." I said, "Yeah, I know. I kind of invited them." He became really unhinged and said, "Damn it, don't ever do that without telling me. You scared the hell out of me." He could feel, also, that there was an intelligent being, materialized, but like a projection of awareness, from the ship inside the room. We went into the living room, and the ship followed us around to that side of the house, to the big picture window overlooking Grandfather Mountain. By then, I think they sensed my friend's fear, and with that, the ship backed off, went out over the valley, and swoosh, streaked away, off into space over Grandfather Mountain. The very next day, we heard on radio and in news reports that 2 spaceships were found on the radar at Douglas Airport in Charlotte, North Carolina. They were pursued by a police helicopter called Snoopy. I was stunned to hear that the area of the city where the sightings were centered was where I was born and grew up, the spot I'd shown them in my vectoring through consciousness. One of the craft apparently got very close to the police helicopter, and also to an Eastern Airlines jet. This was all recorded by the air traffic control tower, and it confirmed this. 5 years later, a man who had acquired the FA audio tape of that event shared the tape with me. We have it in the SETI archives, in the transcript. One of the craft just vanished, and the other one was seen and tracked going off towards the northwest, the mountains where I was located. And, in fact, it then appeared outside my window. So, that was an interesting earlies, 5 that not only had another witness, my hapless housemate, but also was tracked on radar, observed by commercial airline pilots, and chased by a police helicopter. Frankly, I was stunned and a bit unnerved by the precision of the event. I thought, wow, this is serious. I really shouldn't do this any more until I formalize a program for it. And, in fact, I didn't do it again, from 1977 to 1990, when I formed the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI. Prove this point, if one is to believe that rubbish, you would think that every other person in America is being snatched from their homes at midnight and tortured. It simply isn't true. But fear and horror sells, and the usual suspects benefit from a terrified, misinformed populace. We know that clandestine paramilitary operations exist, controlled by a shadowy group staging simulated UFO/ETV events. This is not speculation. We have interviewed many independent corroborating military people who have participated on the teams that have deliberately abducted people to create the illusion of real extraterrestrial encounters. In the UFO industry, there is the multi-million dollar abduction subculture, funded by powerful, wealthy interests, including certain European royal families along with industrial scions in the United States. Stories publicized are very deliberately selected. If someone comes to one of the abduction support groups and researchers with the account I've shared, they will be shown the door. They only want to select the terrifying stories, those from people who have had simulated encounters, foisted on them by a military effort that is trying to create psychological propaganda. This will support future Star Wars expenditures down the road by sowing the seeds of division between humans and extraterrestrial people. It is part of a well-thought, out plan to divide one group against another. And in order to do this, a threat must be demonstrated, and the supposed enemy demonized. So most of the UFO/ET information put out is designed by counterintelligence, psyops and disinformation people for a specific, intended effect. The first is simply to discredit the subject, because most of their stories don't hold up under scrutiny. The second, in my opinion, is to create a foundation of fear upon which to build the edifice of Star Wars. And no less a figure than Wernher von Braun told a member of our team, Carol Rose Ein, that, in fact, this was exactly what was going on, that weapons will be based in space, hence, the need to create a psychological nexus where people will fear all things alien. Then, down the road, when the folks enjoying the multi-trillion dollar bonanza of current industrial and military operations decide the deception has gone on long enough, they can declare the world needs to unite around kicking alien butt, as quoted from the movie, Independence Day. Keep in mind that the Cold War and all the things going on today will pale in comparison to the financial benefit to be gained by stampeding the masses into a false idea of a threat from outer space that must be resisted. Instead of extracting unlimited dollars for the military operations from the United States and the West, the imagined threat will produce enough xenophobia to ensure a blank check, or steady flow of government dollars, in the name of preserving safety and world peace. Sound familiar? This assessment comes from having interviewed numerous military people inside the organizations dealing with this. I've been told point blank that this has been an ongoing agenda since at least the 1950s. These operations have used something called alien reproduction vehicles, manufactured by a consortium of companies that include Lockheed Martin, Northrop, SAIC, E-Systems, AGG and MITRE Corporation, among others. These are man-made anti-gravity devices that we've been using since at least the 50s, along with other powerful electronic weapons systems and programmed life forms or PLFs.